that we won't have a clipboard, or have a little clapboard this time, but I'll just go over the opening.
Go ahead, I'm rolling and recording.
Okay. Today is Friday, August 31. I'm H.F. Williamson. I'm interviewing Ralph Langenheim for the second day. This is for the Veterans History Project of the Library of Congress American Folklife Center. We are at Studio X, Campbell Hall, Urbana, Illinois. Henry Radcliffe is the director of lighting, sound, and camera. Ralph, why don't you begin?
Okay, well, when we left off, I'd managed to get the LCIL 551 to Charleston, South Carolina for refitting. But unfortunately, my memory isn't perfect, and I don't always have my wits about me, and I'm doing this ad hoc. So I skipped over some things in Italy and in North Africa, human interest type stuff, that I'd like to double back and pick up.
Fine.
As you may remember, we carried troops from Naples up to Livorno, Leghorn, in 200 man batches in LCIs. They took them off the transports that had brought them from the United States and Brazil and elsewhere, rather than risk those large ships that close to the front line. And we carried two loads of Brazilians, the Brazilian Expeditionary Force. We carried a group of Italians who had been formed up into labor battalions in the Italian army, which at that point was supporting the Allies. And we also carried, Brazilians, Italians.
An American division, as I remember, the 95th, was it? Or?
Oh, yes, the 96th division, which was the African-American infantry division, which is so big in the news these days. It was a very large unit, and it went into the lines. So anyway, when they pulled the 45th division and the 36th division out of the line, they fought all the way up England, up the spine of Italy, they replaced them with these untested troops, the Brazilians and the 96th, and we took them up there, some of them. They were a different group of people, certainly. As a person who had been raised in Oklahoma in a segregated school system and all that, it was one of my first experiences with African Americans who hadn't been involved in, who hadn't been sort of suppressed. And I had to deal with the troop officer, who I found to be a very edgy and aggressive person. I realize now why he was. But I had a real confrontation with him. He wanted me to bet on Army and the Army-Navy game, which was being played that day, and I don't bet. And I was trying to tell him I didn't want to bet, and that was a real, real tussle with that guy. Huh. And another thing that happened with those, we had all kinds of problems, but when we loaded that company up, and took them out and anchored for the night before we went out over the next morning. A couple of them apparently jumped overboard and swam ashore and left behind their weapons. So we inherited a couple of M1 Garands. We offered them to the commanding officer. He said, I don't need them. I don't have anybody to carry them. And it really turned out that they weren't wanted because they were jammed and so on and had not been very well cared for. But anyway, that was that experience. Now, the Brazilians, on the other hand, Getulio Vargas, the dictator of Brazil, was trying to get Brazil its stripes as a major power, so he almost insisted on sending troops to Europe for the war. And so the Brazilian Expeditionary Force was the result. This was another experience for me, in that I hadn't dealt with Latin Americans in quite such bulk. And so when the troop officer on the first group peeled off his watch and gave it to me in a typical social thing for in that culture, I was somewhat taken aback, and I didn't have anything to give him back. I know I was embarrassed by that. And another thing that happened with the Brazilians, one of the loads, we got up to Livorno, and we were ready to unload, and their medical officer came up, and he says, we have to wait. We may be quarantined. And he had very poor English, and my high school Spanish didn't pass for Portuguese, so we had trouble communicating. He says, one of our men has the cachumba. Cachumba? What's cachumba? I questioned him about it. Finally, he forced himself to give an English. He says, mumpus. So we were about to be quarantined in Leghorn, Italy, with 200 Brazilian soldiers with mumps aboard. I'd never had mumps. I didn't look forward to that. But it was resolved, and they did go ashore. Now, let's see. Other things that happened in Pozzuoli, that fourth officer, drama guy, Rip Colbert, they call him, cooked up a scam on our captain, hired a teenage prostitute to come down to the...
Now, is this the same captain you started
this
with?
This was Buswell, no, the replacement captain,
okay.
the Mormon deacon, bishop, excuse me, to embarrass him, come down to the ship and announce herself as having been reserved or called for by the captain.
Oops.
And so this lady undulated down to the dock and stood there flipping grapes in the air and catching them in her mouth and asking for, Capitan, you sent for me. And poor old Buzzy turned several shades of red before that lady finally left. But we had a lot of lighthearted moments on board the ship as well as not so lighthearted. And then the captain, the fourth officer that had tuberculosis, we lost him in Naples. The pharmacist mate, our conscientious Marzalek, had been trying to get this guy into a naval hospital from the time we got to Europe. And finally, he just threw up his hands one day and grabbed O'Brien, and they hitchhiked into the naval hospital in Naples, which was quite a distance away. And he finally got him in front of an X-ray camera, and they wouldn't let him come back. So we had to ship his gear to him. But that's when O'Brien left the ship, and this fellow, Colbert, came aboard. Down in Bizerte, there were a couple of interesting things, which is minor, really. Buswell and I went ashore on shore leave and just wandered around town, and we wandered into the marketplace, the souk, and it was just like the Arabian Nights. I mean, there were guys in long robes and Arab headdress, long beards, sitting, playing chess at tables, and all the sights and sounds and smells of that marketplace. And we enjoyed it tremendously until the MPs came and scooped us up. It was off limits, and we knew it was off limits. Anyway, they popped us into a Jeep and hauled us away. Another shore leave there, we contracted for a meal in a private home, French colonial people in Bizerte who were interested in making a few dollars. Rather simple meal in a concrete block and stucco house with very Mediterranean, very different. So those are a few things that happened there. But to get back to Charleston, they gutted the ship and rebuilt the insides of it and took half of our crew away, including this Colbert fellow, and a new gang of people came on board. So we half crew were old-timers and half of them were brand new. We went through some rudimentary training and then started off for the Pacific coast, going down the coastline and up along the Keys in Florida. And by this time, the Atlantic was secure, so they turned on the lights. The lighthouses were operating, and the ships had their navigational lights. And one memory is swinging down from lighthouse to lighthouse on the coast of Florida.
Yeah.
As one was fading into the distance, you'd pick up the next one, and you'd do your piloting on those. A very pleasant cruise down to Key West, a little time in Key West, and then off across the Caribbean. We were still in convoy. It was a purely LCI convoy. There were no escort vessels, and the navigation was being done by LCI officers, which led to a contretemps when we arrived at the coast of Panama, when the convoy commodore signaled a course to port to get to the Panama Canal, and Buswell and some of the other captains who also were doing their navigating had a different position. Quite a bit of the idea was we really had to turn right to the canal, and there was sort of a caucus of captains, and they overruled this guy, fortunately, because we did have to go to starboard to get into the canal. Voyage across the Caribbean was also a new thing for us. The weather was pretty calm, and it was warm. And there were flying fish and dolphins, quite a bit of life. Every morning we'd have to sweep off a couple of flying fish that had not made a wet landing, and so on and so forth. It was very pleasant. and then on and through the canal, down the other side, and out into the Pacific and up the coast. And that, too, was sort of different. Now, on that side, we did go without our navigation lights and did have an escort because there were Japanese submarines in the Pacific Ocean, and theoretically we could have been attacked. But the interesting thing about the trip up the west coast of Central America is that we were going through a marine upwelling area where deep, cold waters were current was coming, impinging on the coast and then rising along that coastline, bringing nutrients and high organic content in the water, and as a result, a lot of marine life, dolphins all over the place. And sailing for half a day in a sea dotted with yellow sea turtle shells scattered around, and fishermen in small boats, and at night those small boats all had lights and they bobbed up and down, so you had flashing lights. More about that later on. And on one occasion we had a giant ray come up right underneath us and broach in front of the ship. The wingspan of the thing looked to be as wide as the ship.
Wow.
And sharks and seabirds by the jillions. And our crews, depending upon the ship, behaved very badly. They used those turtles for target practice, and they shot at the seabirds and just wanton slaughter of marine life. Fortunately, Buswell had a conscience, and that was strictly forbidden on board our ship, as it was on board my gunboat when we were coming back south later on in the war. When I did let a guy fire at a seabird, and I was sure he was going to miss, and by God, he hit him. I'm still embarrassed by that. But anyway, we got up to San Diego and went into San Diego and went into a training mode. And about 2 weeks later, we had a couple of cases of venereal disease that had to go to the hospital. We had a good time in Panama on the way down. Cocosolo, we had shore leave there. Got into a bars with bar girls and right out of a B-grade movie. And this fellow Marzalek borrowed the Buswell's uniform and went ashore as an officer with Buswell's connivance. I learned that just a few years ago. That was quite a story. But training, we got a new officer, a fellow by the name of Alan Hamilton, replaced the fourth officer that we had picked up at Charleston. The fourth officer was one of the guys that went to the hospital and didn't come back. We never found out what he had, but we had our suspicions. But Alan Hamilton is the man who took the picture, some of which you will be seeing, I suppose. And he took pictures on our trip up to Alaska, and I have a full set of those. We did a number of things. One practice landing situation out on one of the Channel Islands. We entangled the anchor cable in our screw and had quite a show with people trying to get it cut off. We finally just had to cut it off. We weren't able to take care of that. Went back on one screw. Had to go into dry dock to get disentangled. Hitchhiked up to the lighthouse. Got on. Good stories. But basically, it was just training to get ready for going to Asia, and we were all in some trepidation over that. But finally we got orders to proceed up to Alaska, where our ships were to be lend-leased to the Soviet Navy.
Oh.
So a group
this
of
six... This was what date, approximately? What date was this?
Alaska?
What month and year was this?
Shortly before the end of the war, because the war ended while I was on board transport coming back from that.
Okay.
So this was in 1946. But
you were training in the summer of 45 for the Asian theater?
Yeah.
Okay.
45 or 46, I'd have to check that. I've got it all in that book. That book's accurate because I got a hold of the ship's log, so there's a good timeline for it. But anyway, uneventful voyage up to Seattle, and another yard availability. They cleaned us up like brand new, painted out the two French flags that we had painted on the conning tower in honor of our being in Normandy and southern France landing. As soon as the base authorities turned their backs, we painted them back on, and that's the way the Russians got that ship. After all, they were buying a used car, or getting a used car. And what did we do in Seattle? Well, usual leave-type stories, shore leave-type stories, nothing of any particular note. Finally, we took off for Alaska via the Inside Passage. And we took off in the afternoon and sailed overnight up the inside of Vancouver Island and arrived at night the next day at the tip of Vancouver Island and anchored overnight. And from then on, we traveled in daylight only. So we went up the Inside Passage in daylight all the way. Miles and miles of traveling up narrow channels covered with trees, and here and there a clearing, an Indian village maybe, or a cannery or something like that. We saw the glow of Prince Rupert as we went by, and finally up to Ketchikan and shore leave there. Went ashore with our new engineering officer, who was a Mustang, by the way, an ex-enlisted man. Drank a little bit too much and bought a wonderful Eskimo ivory item, a little goose, on the way back to the ship. I never would have bought it if I'd been cold sober. I still have it, and it's one of my most cherished possessions. Sometimes poor judgment is good judgment. And on up, we knocked down a dock in one of the places where we anchored for the night. Tide tried tying up to it. It was rickety, barren off, hot springs. And finally came out into the Gulf of Alaska. And shortly the radioman comes trundling up, and he'd been listening to Tokyo Rose. And Tokyo Rose had welcomed our six ships to the Gulf of Alaska, citing the numbers.
Oh, my.
So there must have been some Japanese coast watcher or a submarine around that spotted us as we came out. It was a little bit disconcerting because we didn't have an armed escort. And then trundled on out to Kodiak Island and rested a little bit there. Got shore leave. Alan Hamilton and I had a wonderful hike up in the tundra on top of the island. He didn't find any bears, fortunately. And then out along the Alaska Peninsula, past Pavlov Volcano, which is a very active volcano. It was puffing out a bit of smoke every 5 minutes, 10 minutes. Sailed past that. One of the pictures that you see will be maybe a group of our ships going past Pavlov. And out to Cold Bay, Fort Randall, an army base had been put in when they were in for the Aleutians campaign and was still in use. Quonset huts on tundra, no trees, very bleak, very cold. And the Russians, we took aboard a Russian crew. The captain was a regular Russian naval officer, a graduate of their naval academy, but he was Mongolian. A little bit of a shock. And at night on watch, when you were with him, he would sing operatic arias. That's how he amused himself. Very different. The Russians ran the ship differently. We had six machinists and one gunner's mate. They had five gunner's mates and two machinists. They didn't really treat the machinery with much respect. They'd up anchor and crank up full speed ahead from a dead standstill, just shaking the ship to pieces. We were, well, not quite to pieces, it didn't come apart, but we were sure that they would damage it. They would ram those beaches at full speed, and it was, since we weren't unloading anybody, it was chancy pulling off, and so on. But we had our time. They bought all of our underwear. Their underwear could have been made of canvas. they had money, and they bought all kinds of things. But then it came time to transfer command. And the first thing they did before we went up to make the actual transfer is they brought up all the ship's whiskey and the five officers, 10 officers drank it all. So we were all tipsy when we went up to go through the ceremony, and I called both crews to hand salute about 4 minutes early. I remember that. But anyway, then it was a Russian ship, and we all went back, and they went on to Vladivostok. Now, stories came back. The story that came back was that they had run it on a rock on the way over. When they didn't. It got to Vladivostok. It did participate in carrying troops down to the Kurils when the Japanese occupied the Kurils. And it ultimately was returned to the U.S. service and was stricken from the list like every other LCI by the Navy. And I don't know what happened to it after it was stricken from the list. Various things happened to LCIs when they were stricken from the list. Some of them ended up as tour boats in New York Harbor and were still in service at the time of 9/11. They'd been extensively remodeled. I know that because they were hauling refugees to the New Jersey shore after the bombing. Some of them, two of them were bought by the CIA and participated in the Bay of Pigs landing. A bunch of them went to the French in Vietnam and were transferred to the Vietnamese Navy and were ultimately retrieved and ended up in the Philippine Navy. A bunch of them were given to the British and went to India, and I don't know what happened to them. Some were given to Argentina. I don't know what happened to them. But most of them were junked, and actually the engines were the valuable thing. They would jerk the engines, those GMC engines, and they ended up in the logging business here, there, and elsewhere. And then the rest of them were scrapped for scrap iron. There are only two of them still left afloat that we know of, unless the tour boats in New York Harbor haven't been replaced. But anyway, they're interesting stories as to what happened to those things, and we tried to track them down. I'm trying to write a little article about the Barbara J and Blagar, which are the two that were the command boats for the Bay of Pigs landing. But I can't find a lot of stuff. It's very difficult.
Do you want to say who we is, the what? Group? Do you want to tell us who we is, the group that's doing this? There is a group of LCI veterans that meets regularly?
Well, I'm writing an article for the LCI item on that, if I can get it all together. But that's the we is me. I'm interested in the history of this. So anyhow, I can find out that those things were bought by the CIA from a company that I can't identify, which may have been an offshoot of George Bush's Zapata offshore drilling people who were down there and may or may not have been mixed up in it. The Barbara J was not named after Barbara Bush. There's no J in her name, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then they disappear after the landings. Let's see. We're about ready to come home from Alaska. Okay, so they put me on board. They flew us up to Dutch Harbor, or Kodiak rather, and put us on board a transport. And we were living inside a transport with a bunch of LCI officers going back. And then I got 30 days leave. Rode the train to Minneapolis, to St. Des Moines, and from Des Moines to Kansas City, and from Kansas City down to Tulsa. It was a long trip on trains in those days. Mm-hmm. And enjoyed my leave and was posted to command of a ship in the Pacific Fleet, the LCIG 397. It's a gunboat. And was ordered to report to Okinawa to pick that ship up. So it was on the train out to San Francisco, report to the Naval District there, housed in San Francisco until a transport was available, and then rode a transport to Okinawa and was put on board the LCIG 397. LCIG 397 was a member of the so-called Black Cat Flotilla, and I quite remember the number of it, which is memorialized by its commanding officer, Rear Admiral Morrow, I believe it is. I have to check that out. we're beyond my book by now. Anyhow, he, Morrill was his name. He had been in command of a minesweeper in Manila Bay at the time of the war broke out. And when he was ordered to surrender, he didn't. He gathered together a group of his crew members, and they took a Liberty boat, which is about a 25-foot diesel launch, and proceeded to sail it to Darwin, Australia.
Wow.
So he escaped from the... There's a couple of books about that, one by Morrill with somebody or other, and then a fictionalized version of it, which is pretty horrible, but it was quite an extensive thing. And then he was offered anything he wanted in the way of posting. He said, I want to be in a place where I can kill Japanese. And they said, well, the amphibious force. So he took command of an amphibious force, an LCI flotilla, and was responsible for a number of things. Apparently he was responsible for the fact that we were actually issued navigational equipment. And the notion was that the reserve officers would be so limited in their capabilities that they could cross the ocean following somebody that was able to navigate. Well, we got our sextants, and we did use them, and things of that sort. And they were involved in the landings on Guam, but most notably, they were the holding force after the Peleliu. They were in Peleliu, and also the holding force when the Japanese were just isolated up at the north end of that chain of islands. And they had really hairy time of it. And he wrote this thing up himself after he was 80, I guess, with the aid of his wife, I guess. Anyway, it's a real fine book. It's a hard one to get a hold of. But he's never been written up as a World War II character. He was somebody who was not particularly enchanted with Halsey and the establishment and said so. Hmm. And he did great things. So somebody should... Some writer should pick that up and put out a book on this guy. But anyway, I reported aboard, and these guys were all duly impressed by the fact that this man had been at Normandy, and I've told you about what happened to us at Normandy, like essentially nothing in the way of blood and guts and so on. Well, I was intimidated somewhat by taking over a crew that had been in several hotly contested landings and had suffered casualties and blah, 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 and had been through the typhoon and all of that. So there was a mutual respect and fear thing there. Anyway, I took command of that and brought it back all the way across the Pacific Ocean. Lay two off of Saipan. We didn't go ashore. Had some time at Pearl Harbor waiting there, traveling in convoy. And finally got to San Diego and got orders for New Orleans. And I pumped that up with my crew. They were looking forward to having a decent shore leave finally. Shore leave in the Pacific was they put you in a Higgins boat and took you over to a sandbar where they opened a keg of beer. It was all guys and didn't really serve the purpose. Well, it did. It served it, but not very well. So anyway, they were all set to go, except some of them had their numbers were coming up. We were losing crew members like flies. And something happened. Somebody dropped a wrench into the gears on one of the engines.
Uh-oh.
We sort of thought maybe it was somebody whose numbers were due to come up while we would be en route to the Gulf Coast. But anyway, with the connivance of those of us that wanted to go, we fixed that. The Navy Yard wanted to just decommission us right there, but instead they issued us some grinding tools, and we went to work, and we fixed that, and went on around. So we went down the coast again, through all of the sea life and the turtles and so on and so forth. And my ship was a flagship. A little bit about that. I turned in my orders to the commanding officer of that flotilla in Okinawa. Very formal naval occasion. He had diarrhea, and he was ensconced in the throne of China in shorts and no shirt. I turned over my orders to take command of the ship. There's a fellow by the name of Edgar Lewis Yates. He was had been taken into the Navy from the Merchant Marine and reputedly had spent more time afloat than the shore all of his life. He was really a hard-nosed character. I established a pretty good relationship with him. For example, coming into Honolulu on the way back, I had the bridge and he was up there, and there were some small boats at a dock alongside in the narrow channel, and our wakes were just tossing, you know, smashing them up. So I just ordered a decrease to 1/3 speed without seeking authorization from the flotilla commander, and he turned around and snapped at me, "Why did you do that? Blah, 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 blah." I told him why I did that, and he said, "Good." I mean, he was okay. He was stern, but okay. But anyway, we're on our way down the coast, and we have radar, search radar, PPI, as they call it, planned position indicator. And we had that going, and I was asleep. I didn't have the watch. In fact, I didn't have to have a watch. I was a commanding officer, but I did take one because I liked it. And the messenger comes down and said, "We're headed on a collision course with the land." He says, "Come on up." And here it is. We were in the Gulf of Nicoya, and ahead of us there was a lighthouse. We could identify it by its signal, spacing of the flashing lights, distinguish it from all the fishing boats. So here we are, headed for shore with a whole gang of ships. So we rung up the officer in tactical command and acquainted him of that fact. He didn't have radar. He was one of the unequipped ships. So we changed course, and we didn't pile up on the shore. Our reward for that was 24-hour radar watch. But it wasn't too long to get to Panama from the Gulf of Nicoya. And we get to Panama, and they bring us into the harbor with a good current running through it, and told us to wait, and left us there until mid-afternoon, waiting for our turn to go through and waiting for a pilot. And finally, the order comes down to us individually, proceed into the locks and through the canal. No pilot. Well, we'd been maneuvering. We'd had special sea detail on all that time. You know, the first-class guys, the number one officers and men for all those positions to be alert. And here we are going through the Panama Canal without a pilot. And needless to say, it was both a challenge and a stimulation. It was great fun. Mm. So we went on through with all those guys still on duty. I mean, they had about a 20-hour day. And we got up to the other side, up in the lake, and we're waiting to get in the locks. And finally, they signaled us to enter the locks. And there was a Honduran banana boat already in the lock just ahead of us. So we ease into the lock. And I call for reverse all engines to stop us just short of the boat, you know. Mm-hmm. And in the confusion, somebody along the way gave us all a head full. So it was like standing on the accelerator while you're easing into a parking place. So we reversed that order and also steered for the side of the lock and managed to snubber down without hitting the banana boat. Heard a lot of fast Spanish, but we got in. We got down to Cocosolo. Or is it Panama? Cocosolo. And docked, and our orders were changed. We weren't going to New Orleans. We weren't going to Big Easy. We weren't going to have a fancy, nice time at leave and all of that. We were ordered to set out at dawn with no shore leave for Galveston, Texas. Mm. Well, there was a certain amount of resentment over that. It was like being offered a trip to, I don't know, New Orleans and being sent to Tolono. But that is unfair. I shouldn't have said that. But anyway, off we went. And it just turned out that, and alone, which meant that I had to find my way to Galveston with my little sextant. The only time that ever happened, a high point in my life. Well, the next evening, late afternoon, we arrived at Old Providence Island, Vieja Providencia, which is a Colombian island, Colombian possession in the Caribbean Sea, north of Panama. And I decided, what the heck? Our guys need some shore leave, so we'll just stop here. So we take the chart. The chart was one of the charts that we had inherited from the British Navy. It had been made by a British naval vessel that had been wrecked there in the early 1800s. Oh. And that's how they occupied themselves until somebody came around to rescue them. It's at the bottom, it said, caution, coral may have grown as much as 2 feet.
Whoops.
We had a very shallow draft, 5 feet. And the southern entrance to the harbor had 10 feet, supposedly. So we came in that way to the consternation of the people on shore. Here's this big ship coming in this passage with no water, and they came out screaming at us. And as a matter of fact, we did sort of scrape a little bit of coral on the way in. Oops. But we came in and flipped down the anchor, and all of these lowland Spanish-speaking Caribbeans, African-Americans, if you want to call Afro-Colombians, came out in their canoes, and we sent everybody but a skeleton crew ashore. And I came in and was ushered up to the seat of power, which was right out of Somerset Maugham. It was a wattle shack with a balcony and a thatched roof, and a portly Spanish-speaking Colombian who was the governor, and some other people. And we sat there drinking cold rum drinks while the guys went around town and had their fun and rotated. And the next morning, we went out through the proper entrance. Well, it was a big thing for the Vieja Providencians because it was the only U.S. naval vessel that ever actually came in. Actually, Franklin Roosevelt had come in on a launch and circled around the harbor and gone out when his cruiser went by one time. But so we did that, and so I set a beeline course for Galveston, right across a coral-strewn sea, the so-called Quita Sueña banks, no sleep banks, poorly charted. Depths, presumably, enough for us to get by. And there was enough water. It was a very foolhardy thing to do. If I'd been a competent naval officer, I wouldn't have done that. But I went on across there, and the first landfall was Swan Island. Missed it. Didn't see Swan Island, which isn't too difficult because Swan Island is a very low island, and we were only 32 feet off the water. The horizon was only about less than 10 miles out, so if we... And our navigation wasn't that sharp. Went between Cuba and Yucatan, well out to sea, and didn't see him. Sailed across the Gulf of Mexico, not seeing a thing, till finally a buoy appeared. And guess what? It was the Galveston Sea Buoy. So either this amateur pulled off a coup, or there was a lot of compensating error along the way. You could take your choice. So we come up on the harbor, and it was blowing, and we started in, and we were told to anchor and wait, and we didn't hear them. So we had lots of engines, and we could always back into the wind, and we bulled our way into the harbor, turned and went along the docks, and bulled our way into the dock without doing any damage at all, and we got in. The next day, they sent us up the Houston Ship Canal to be decommissioned, tied up at the dock. And we made a ceremony out of it. Everybody got up in their dress whites, and we lined up on the deck, and we read the orders and saluted and hauled down the flag, hauled down the commission pennant, the one that you're seeing there. And the ship was decommissioned, and that was the end of my sea duty in the U.S. Navy. I had orders to report to New Orleans for decommissioning. Hopped on a train, went over to New Orleans, went into the naval base, was there for a few days. Went over to see the town, saw the French Quarter, Canal Street, and all that. I was challenged by a street purveyor of raw oysters. They had a counter up there, and they were splitting the oysters and serving them out, and I was sort of watching that like that. And the guy says, "I'll give you one if you'll eat it." So that was the first time I ever ate raw oysters, and I've been partial to them ever since. I haven't had hepatitis yet. Waiters tell me, "Okay, are you sure you want raw oysters? Will you sign this?" But anyway, that was that. And I then got decommissioned, got my papers, got my train ticket home, went on up to Tulsa on the railroad, came home, and I had served 3 years and 5 days on active duty. So that gave me 4 years of GI Bill, which saw me through to my PhD. Oh. I had 5 days left when I used up the last of it. And it was all in all a good deal, a good deal. And I guess maybe that's about all I can dredge up to talk to you now. I'll think of more after we left, but I apologize for not being as quick-witted as I was yesterday, but apparently the clock's running down. Okay.
How emotional was... You had been on that ship. When you passed the ship on to the Russians as part of the Lend-Lease, that was the ship you had been on throughout that part of your career. How emotional was that moment to leave that ship? Was it a sad moment, or...?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't really sad. That ship is in my memory, as you can well see. So is the other one. The guys, some of those men, were like me, were plank owners. That had been so I was with that ship for its entire career.
Exactly.
And until it went into the Russian Navy, and I found out about what happened to it. And I can, you know, draw an X on it and say here's. Rest in peace. You were stricken from the list on such and such a day. I don't know whether you were melted down or whether you ultimately ended up in the hands of the CIA invading Cuba. You didn't, because that was a subsequent class. From the pictures I've seen of those ships, they were round con bow door types, which succeeded ours. But no, it wasn't emotional. I'm attached to those people. I'm still in communication with them. They helped me with putting together this book. I wrote it seated in front of a yellow pad while my wife was sleeping until noon on a cruise to Puerto Vallarta. Most of it, wrote it out. It was all garbled. Then I got the ship's log and straightened it out on time. Then I typed it up and I sent it off to these guys, those of them that I knew of. And they edited it and gave me further stuff, and it's been going back and forth. There's a fellow named John Cox, who was a signalman, lives in Oregon. He's a farmer, a rancher. There's Buswell, who became a dentist and had a career in Ogden, Utah. I don't remember the name of the town now. And was something of a figure in the Mormon church. And a fellow named McLeese, who lives in Iowa, is a farmer. Lost track of him. I haven't been getting answers from him lately. There was a fellow who was a bosun's mate, name escapes me at the moment, who was in on it in the early stages of it and then passed away. And then Alan Hamilton, who sent me copies of all those photos he took on the way up to Alaska, but apparently wants to forget about having been in the Navy. I don't get answers. I get answers from him on other things. I mean, we became corresponding friends, but he's not interested particularly in LCI. LCIs are the Navy. So those people are important. They corroborate the stories. They don't necessarily corroborate all of them. The one about the Senegalese prostitutes, for example, that did not happen to us. It's one of those tricks of memory. But they're there. And you don't have that book here, do you?
It may be here, but...
Well, anyway, the little quote in the front of it is a quotation from the guy that wrote the story of the conquest of Mexico, the only full A to Z account of it. Wrote it in his 80s while he was a rancher in Guatemala, and indignantly announces that he's setting this down because others who were not there are telling stories that just aren't true. So that's what you read when if you ever pick up the book. That'll be on the fly page. Now, we know that those stories, your recall is not perfect, and you remember things that you were told about as having been there, and you remember details that aren't there. It tends to be glamorized. Things that are either horrible or very pleasant come to the forefront, and the details get lost. And it's a real effort to try to put down a, quote, true account, without exaggerations, and a true and complete account. And this thing that I've written isn't going to be such, and I submit that no history book is such. There are techniques and tools of scholarship that enable you to be reasonably accurate. For example, you can get original documents like the log, ship's log. You can get combat reports and so on, and I've got some of those. And you can flesh it out that way, and you can correct and corroborate those. But it is as you see it. And there's a responsibility there, which I hope I'm discharging.
I would think there are too many areas where there aren't people such as you who are putting down these histories while they still have the memories to write them down.
Well, there are a lot of them. I understand there are 60 people submitting to these interviews, so that's a lot of them. There's the Oral History Project that's been run by the Naval Institute, which deals mostly with more senior people in positions of big responsibility. Most of the admirals have done that. There are a myriad of memoirs like mine, of varying degrees of reliability and editorial polish and so on. You can find them on the internet. You get the whole thing. I was reading one last night, a guy that is an evangelical preacher. He's mostly talking about his preaching career, but he does talk about there are too few paragraphs about his naval career. And they're out there. And that's sort of these things. The thing that you're doing here, we're doing here, in a sense, is the raw material from which professional, scholarly, I use put that in quotation mark, historians will compose their monographs. Some of which will be readable, which will be popularizations, which will be less reliable, and some of which will be so detailed and so thorough that nobody but another historian will be willing to read them. Except somebody that's working up policy. People that work up policy for the government ought to be reading history. If some of them had been a little bit closer to that, we might not be in some of the messes that we find ourselves right now.
Well, that might be a very nice closing note for our interview. We have been talking to Ralph Langenheim as part of the Veterans History Project of the Library of Congress, American Folklife Center at Studio X, WILL-TV, Campbell Hall, Urbana, Illinois. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Oh, good grief. That's that cliche that everybody interviewed on
That's
TV.
It has been a pleasure from my perspective.
Are we still on the air? I better not say what I really wanted to say.